This is kind of how I feel. Do every at bat that's kind of quote unquote used should be done in a worthwhile manner, should be telling you something about the future. And on a fundamental level, you want to either be winning now or winning later. And if the things you do with these at bats don't do either, then there's no point.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the Bless You Boys podcast. BlessYouBoys.com is your home for all things Detroit Tigers baseball on the SB Nation platform. And I have a special guest for you, Dan Szymborski from Fangraphs and the creator, operator of the Zips projection system, which we use constantly. Dan, how's it going tonight?
It's going pretty well. Yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. Hanging in there, you know. Trying to enjoy the last bits of fall here. Well, I don't know, maybe not the last bits, but the last bits of summer
fall,
is probably more accurate.
Fall doesn't even start for like 6 days.
Yeah.
We will not have this non-weather thing here where we're talking about the end of fall.
where do you live generally, if I may ask?
I am in Ohio. I'm from Baltimore.
Oh, okay. So you're all in the same weather belt generally as we are, yep.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm in Ohio. I'm not like one of those the Ohio State people or anything. It's just out here for family reasons. I don't want to get into a Big Ten fight.
Yeah, that won't happen with me. But not, yeah, and you're not a Midwest native. You're an East Coaster who's been moved into the flat plains of Ohio.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like it's Iowa.
Well, that's true.
There are hills here, and the tornadoes aren't super bad usually. So it's kind of like on the edge of the Midwest.
Yeah, there's water, you know, there's cities. You got that going for you. Yeah.
Yeah, and really inexpensive housing, which is also nice.
Yeah, that is the best part for sure. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I need to fund my life as a lonely middle-aged man living in a 5-bedroom house. You kind of need the Midwest. I can't do that in San Francisco.
No. Yeah, that's true. That's difficult there. Difficult. That's millions of dollars a year.
Yeah, and I need a raise for that.
Yeah.
But I digress.
Yeah, well, I'd advocate for a raise for you. Absolutely.
Okay. I don't know if that works, but maybe I'll just keep names like lists so I can say, hey, Dave, all these people want to give me a raise.
That's right. I've got Dave Appelman's email now, so I can help you out maybe.
Well, don't start writing him emails. I don't know if you'd like that. Besides, he just had a baby, so he's thinking about money for him, I think, at this point.
So he doesn't want to be harassed by random bloggers he doesn't know how to pay his employees more. Well, yeah, I mean, you guys have Fangraphs is, you know, obviously I read Fangraphs every day. I'm a Fangraphs member. I'm super into your site. You guys went through a lot of changes, it seems like, over the past year. I mean, obviously, like, losing Eno Saris, Carson Cistulli, like, a lot of people who'd been around for a long time. And yet, you know, you guys just seem to roll right along. Has you felt like any kind of a year of transition, or is it just, you know, business as usual there?
Well, I mean, I'm part of the year of transition because remember I was at ESPN from 2010 to 2018, and I was always just kind of a friend of Fangraphs until last year where we discussed and I made the jump. I guess I'm one of the few baseball writers who left ESPN voluntarily and didn't get laid off. So that's a plus on my resume, I guess.
Yep.
I still contribute a few pieces a month to ESPN, but I'm full Fangraphs. The analytics committee, it always shifts around. I mean, you have a lot of the same people, but people want to try new things. Jeff Sullivan, he had an opportunity with the Rays he wanted to look at. Carson Cistulli saw a job that was tailored to him in Toronto, the same with Dave Cameron in San Diego. So people move on to different things. It's the way of life, sunrise, sunset.
Yep, that's just the way it goes sometimes. I don't know how much you pay attention to the Tigers, but, you know, based on another, you know, terrible season where we're obviously going to finish in the cellar, and we appreciate you coming to visit us here in the dank Michigan basement of Tigers baseball.
Remember, I'm from Baltimore originally, so I'm an Orioles fan, so
yep.
I'm not afraid of cellars and spiders that live down there and Royals.
Yep, exactly. Do you have any sense, like, of how this year has gone, you know, for the Tigers organizationally, like, overall, the minor leagues, the major league club, the whole thing?
I would kind of say in the middle. I like a lot of the things that the Tigers have going for them, but there's also a lot of things that kind of concern me. I wouldn't count me in as, like, the biggest fan of the front office. I don't think it's one of the top tier front offices. I mean, I like the pitching prospects they have in the minors. I think anybody would. I still have concerns about them developing hitters.
Yeah.
And I And long term, I kind of wonder how aggressive they really are making moves when they're necessary. Because you see a lot, I mean, yeah, they weren't going to trade Miguel Cabrera even before the contract. But they always seem to be like a year too late with trading guys. And the Reds kind of did that. And that hurts your rebuild in a way, because I suspect that the Cubs got, I mean, the Tigers got less for Nicholas Castellanos than they would have a year ago. I think that they probably could have gotten more for Victor Martinez at the start of that season, or even in the season before. You can go on and on. I mean, I'm sure that most Tigers fans, especially, you know, the more stat savvy ones that would be on your site, probably also feel like that they could have gotten a lot better value for Fulmer if they didn't think he was an ace for some reason after his rookie year. So I think it's a team that doesn't necessarily always grab the bull by the horns, but it's not one of the teams I consider to be in the baseball equivalent of development hell. Like the Royals are, I feel. I think the Rockies are headed in that direction. I think the Angels are, even to a degree. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, the Angels are kind of interesting, because when Billy Epler took over there, I kind of expected more. And, you know, obviously they made some good moves. They got Joe Adele in the farm system. They, you know, they definitely found some hitters there, but they still have had zero luck building a pitching staff. And then they hired Brad Ausmus, which for those of us in Detroit is a bit of a red flag, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, if there was a bland doctrinaire use of the bullpen, Brad Ausmus has it like down pat. I mean, you always heard him talking about, like, well, like, how could I use that pitcher? He's my seventh inning pitcher.
Yeah.
Can't use him in the eighth.
Yep. It was like Jim Leland without all the experience, you know, is how it felt.
Yeah, but with Jim Leland, you can make, you know, jokes about, like, smoking. I mean, so many smoking jokes with him.
He was way more fun, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, there was something entertaining about him. I guess when you want your manager to not be perfect, it's fun to have him be old and characterful, and Ausmus isn't really that type yet.
Yeah, that's why we have Guardy now. So, you know, we can get the dad jokes, you know, and the Santa beard going, and yeah, have some good times. Have some yucks while we wait for this thing to turn around. Yeah, you know, Chris Illich, who's the president of the Tigers, was out the other day, and, you know, you don't expect the owner to come out and, you know, to say anything other than that things are going according to plan. But I guess the way I've kind of phrased it is that it really has felt like the Tigers' plan has almost been like the complete, you know, completely opposite of the way the game is going at exactly the wrong time. Like the Tigers spent tons on free agents, you know, say 2014, 2016, they did it again. And that was right almost at the tipping point where teams decided like, no, you know, the expensive free agent thing is over with. We're going to hang on to our prospects. So when the Tigers went to go ahead and trade JD Martinez and Justin Verlander, all of a sudden the returns weren't as good as we saw a few years ago. And yet the whole organization kind of still sort of floats this idea that we're in a rebuild of the sort that like the Cubs or the Astros managed to produce. And it just feels like, you know, the time for all that, you know, was already over by the time, you know, the Tigers got started. I mean, does that kind of ring a bell at all, or seem?
I don't think it's as bleak as you paint a picture, because I mean, the Astros and Cubs, they didn't just rebuild from trading veterans. I mean, that's just one part of it. And they didn't even get it just from the draft. Obviously you get a Carlos Correa from the draft. That's a big deal. You get Chris Bryant. That's a big deal. But really it's just a lot of throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks, because the thing about a rebuilding team is they have the ability to take risks that contending teams can't. I think of Dallas Keuchel with the Astros. He was not a top prospect at the time that he made the majors. But the Astros had the time to look at him in a more effective way than, say, a contending team could. The Yankees wouldn't have been able to afford it to couldn't afford to have a Dallas Keuchel in the rotation for 2 years, waiting to see what happens with him, if everything clicks with him. But the Astros could. And so they had a lot of players that like that. Even like Jose Altuve was not a top prospect. He was not one of the people who made like the, you know, the top 100 prospects list like for 5 years as he came up through the minors. I think that what the Tigers have to be is they have to take advantage of situations, see opportunities, because what Houston and the Dodgers do, and of course the Dodgers have a lot of money, which helps also,
sure.
And the Cubs, is they're very opportunistic. And that's what the Tigers have to do. When they see someone on the waiver wire who's interesting, they have to go for it. I think a classic example of a team that doesn't do this is the Rockies. Earlier this year, when they traded Mike Tauchman to the Yankees, I said at the time that Mike Tauchman is not going to be a star. I don't even know if he's going to be a good player. But the point was that the Rockies didn't really care to find out about that. They traded him to the Yankees. And guys like Tauchman, who are interesting but risky, are who the Tigers should be looking at adding. Players like that. I think the Royals are another good example with Brian Goodwin. I wasn't, honestly, a fan of Brian Goodwin coming into the season. I thought he had a pretty mixed resume. But where the Royals were, they chose Lucas Duda over someone who could have been good. And when you play enough of those guys who could have been good, you find players who actually are good. The Rockies and Tom Murphy. Tom Murphy's having a surprisingly good season for the Mariners. I mean, not every player you pick up like this is going to be a star by any chance, but you have to kind of think of it like you're going to a flea market, and you're like, you know, one of those flea market shows they used to have on PBS. I don't know if they still have those, because I don't know if they're still trendy, because that was like 20 years ago. But you have to find like treasure everywhere. It's not just drafting well, and of course you have to draft well. And then I think one of the positives about the Tigers is I have more of a faith that when the time comes, the Tigers could invest in their team at the major league level, a way that the Royals and the White Sox might not. So that is something they have going for them.
Yeah, or at least may have going for them. Because
may have. I don't want to say a guarantee or anything, because I don't think Chris Illich is going to spend as much as his dad.
Yeah, because there's a lot of people who, you know, who really think that, you know, Chris Illich is kind of just waiting for, you know, for his mom to unfortunately to pass away before, you know, they just decide to sell the team. And I think that's got a lot of people scared that, you know, we're just going to stay in this holding pattern, you know, maybe for another 4 or 5 years with them, you know, trying to turn it around, but not really being that interested in investing, you know, much more capital anyway in the team.
But either way, they're not the Marlins, so take that to heart. Like, yeah, the Marlins have won more games this year, but you'd rather be the Tigers than the Marlins.
Yep. Okay. So one of the things Chris Illich did bring up is, you know, every year he said, you know, I take a look at the prospect rankings, and as long as we're moving up in the the prospect rankings generally, I feel pretty good about it. I mean, what is your take on that? Because, yeah, the Tigers, I mean, I think you guys have the Tigers ninth right now overall. But I do look and I see, you know, Miami way ahead of us. Arizona, these are teams that, you know, theoretically started after us, although you could define that kind of however you want, but do seem to have kind of got the jump on us a little bit as far as overall farm system value, whatever that really means to you.
Well, think of it this way. It's not really a race. Yeah, maybe the Tigers got a slow start, but that just might mean that it takes a little longer. I don't think that you have to worry about the race. I mean, having good pitching prospects, and one of the nice things about the Tigers is that the pitching prospects are generally fairly advanced. When you look at the names that are the good pitching prospects on the team, you know, Mize and Manning and so on, they're guys who have already survived that kind of, you know, rookie league, low A's, high A, that kind of gauntlet, which kind of weeds out a lot of pitchers. I mean, that's why Baseball Prospectus coined the acronym years ago, TINSTAP. There is no such thing as a pitching prospect, which of course isn't literally true, but it's a good thing to remember.
Yeah.
And you know, getting Joey Wentz is still interesting. And I think that they could put together an above average rotation fairly quickly. Because really the rotation isn't even that bad this year. I think Spencer Turnbull's a legitimate mid rotation guy that they can have going forward. I think Matt Boyd, I think he's allowed more home runs than probably he will going forward. So they could have not a top rotation like in the next few years, but I think they could be above average very, very quickly. My larger question is, there's just not a lot of real impact bats in the minors.
Yeah.
I know that the classic, you know, mid lineup slugger is a little passe sometimes, but you still need to have those guys. And the ones that you can see having a lot of power are pretty far away.
Yeah. I mean, apart from Isaac Paredes, it's pretty much, you know, Riley Green, you know, way down, just reaching class A. You know, maybe somebody like Parker Meadows or Bryant Packard, somebody along those lines. So there's a few, but yeah, it's pretty thin. And I think what's kind of worried me is that the pitchers are going to arrive, and the pitching prospects generally take more time to sort of ripen, kind of get used to the workload, all those sorts of things, even in the upper minors. So maybe the timing of it all will work out. But yeah, I think that's the scary part, is that even at the major league level, we don't really have any proven young hitters. We've got a couple guys who have some potential. Kristen Stewart should hit. Can't really play the field very well. There's kind of a whole plethora of semi-speedy, utility-ish guys who are young enough where maybe one of them could break out. But yeah, organization-wide, you have to go pretty far down to the low minors and, rookie ball, maybe the DSL. The Tigers have a couple interesting IFAs down there. But yeah, overall, the hitting looks way, way behind. And I think a lot of us would like to see, if it's true that, free agents are going to be cheaper going forward, that maybe this is the time when the Tigers, should start thinking about investing in some of those guys. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure if I'd say this winter, but yeah. I do think there's a chance that some of these guys are undervalued. I think now would be a little quick. And, I mean, they do have interesting parts in the team, just not a lot of guys who you see being big hitters in the future. Like, I thought it was a really good idea to give Harold Castro as much playing time as they have. Because, no, he's not a real big prospect or anything, but he's interesting. Mm-hmm. And rebuilding teams, they don't have top prospects for every position. Interesting is sometimes enough. When you look at Demerit, he's interesting.
Yeah,
he's not a top prospect, but he's interesting. I mean, he hasn't hit as well as you'd like. That is his play discipline is kind of interesting. Also, I keep using that word. This is in a less positive connotation. Sure. But
at least he does have a track record in the minors of walking, stealing bases, and hitting for some power. Nico Goodrum, another one.
Yeah. See, the way I look at it for a rebuilding team is you have a certain number of plate appearances and batters faced that you have to fill each year. Every year, you need to have like 6,000 guys go to the plate and 6,000 guys that pitchers face. And you have only so much. That's like your time to find out information about things. And when you use, like the Royals have, when they use those opportunities to look at players like Lucas Duda and Billy Hamilton and Chris Owings, they don't really have any information that's going to help them in the future. Because if Billy Hamilton was good or okay, I mean, it's like, so what?
Yeah.
You might be able to get an A-ball hitter for him, but, Edwin Encarnacion fetched very little in a trade. You were never going to get much for Billy Hamilton, even if he had an acceptable season.
Then again, the Tigers do have, guys like Dowell Lugo, who, wasn't really a prospect, doesn't look very good, and they're giving him time. They're giving, Jordy Mercer, Gordon Beckham, some of these guys. Like, Brandon Dixon is a different story, but again, that's like a 27-year-old, former prospect who, maybe has a little something to offer, but not that much. So
yeah, I probably wouldn't be any interested in Harrison or Mercer. I think Lugo's young enough that at least it's worthwhile to see what he can do, even if it's just to say no, because it's not like, he did hit well for the Mudhens this year.
Yep.
Enough just to make him, I know I keep using the word interesting, but it's just kind of how I feel. Do every at-bat that's kind of quote-unquote used should be done in a worthwhile manner, should be telling you something about the future. And on a fundamental level, you want to either be winning now or winning later. And if the things you do with these at-bats don't do either, then it's just no point.
Okay. All right. I think this is interesting because I think you're the guy from Zips, you're the projection master, I think people might assume, and I think I assumed, that you might be a little bit more apt to trust, prospect rankings or the lists or sort of how these guys are projected to work out. But you still seem like to kind of have like a pretty balanced perspective on that, you still don't know. You've got to give these guys some space to at least try it out and see what you can do with them, right?
See, one of the things about running projections, and it actually goes for the other guys who do these things, like Nate Silver and Sean Smith, who did Schoen and Jared Cross, is when you run projections, you are very familiar with how uncertain the future is, and it's driven into your head in much harder lessons than most people have to face.
Yeah.
Because I had to look at projections every year, and I know how horribly wrong I'm going to be about a lot of them. So I want to look for upside. I don't want to get political or anything, so I'm going to stay out of an opinion of that. But when we talk about Nate Silver and the 2016 election, he did not think in his projections that the current president was going to win the election. But he counseled people before the election that some of you guys, your certainty is too little. You have too much certainty about what's going to go on in the election, because you had the one analyst from, I think, Princeton having it like 99% to like less than 1%.
Yeah.
And I think if you're projecting things well and you understand the field, you are going to know just a reality how wrong you're going to be. And that's kind of the advantage of rebuilding, is you can get all the players that I'm wrong about and play them without any consequence. Because if you play, say the Tigers give Paredes like 500 at bats in the majors next year, if I'm wrong and he's terrible, nothing has really lost. Nothing's been lost by the Tigers, because they took the opportunity, because there was always the chance that he was going to be good. Yeah. And if he exceeds his projections and is an even better player than projected, then that's all the Tigers. They get to keep all the wins and the losses mean nothing. So that's kind of how I see it when we talk about a rebuilding team.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, our readership is pretty savvy for the most part, but I think in the wider world, I mean, the sense is that a person who runs projection systems is telling you what's going to happen and what's not going to be happen. Like, people naturally want to think in very binary terms, whereas someone in your position sees the probabilities and the percentages almost only. Like, the right, you know, who's right, who's wrong almost has nothing to do with it, correct?
Yeah, it's like predicting the weather. The goal is to be slightly less terrible than the other guy. And, you know, I mean, I've been doing this a long time. I've had Zips projections for, this is the 16th year, I believe, of official Zips projections. I've consulted a lot in my career. I've written a lot in my career. So I do feel that I have a pretty good grasp of just the general sabermetrics world.
Yeah. And when I put that in my, you know, former English major terms, when I talk to people, it's just that, you know, I might seem to have a rather bleak outlook on a lot of our prospects or this or that, but I will always say that there's just a ton of, you know, unpredictability built into this. And that's the beauty of baseball, is that we can't predict what's going to happen. So don't freak out just because I don't like this or that prospect, you know, and I think this guy doesn't have a chance, etc. You know, at the end of the day, I have no idea, probably, compared to even what you have. And you still have to kind of look at it from a perspective of, well, you know, I'm just trying to be more right than the other guys, and that's the best you can do.
Yeah, it's the old joke about the two campers running from the bear, and the one guy says to the second guy, "You think you can outrun a bear?" And then the first guy says, "No, but I can outrun you."
Yeah, exactly. That's all that's gonna matter. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't like to be wrong, but here's the thing: if I was right 100% of the time, it would be more profitable, because the Zaborski Sportsbook would clear Vegas just. That's where the money is, being the house. But it would be a lot more boring to do this job if I knew exactly what was going on, because I like to be surprised. I want to see the season play out. If everything happened like I predicted, it would just be just excruciatingly dull. I'd probably go into a new field just out of principle and annoyance, because I do have this bad tendency to do things in life if they amuse me in some way. I guess it's kind of, it's not really hedonism. I don't know if they have a word for that.
Is it just being, frivolity? Is that what we're talking about?
I don't know. I just like to be in a constant state of amusement and bemusement.
Okay, yeah, I'm kind of that way. Yeah, I can see that. I'm glad you brought up the sports books, because that was something I did want to ask you about. Is have you ever been approached by MGM, and sort of where do you see the sports, you know, the internet sports, you know, boom that may or may not be coming, kind of affecting things? Do you think you know, people like yourselves are going to get offers, you know, from various news sports books?
I have consulted for a long time. I'm just very reluctant to leave media. It's the same with teams. I've consulted with teams for a long time. I can only since I'm employed as a writer, I can only offer data. I can't offer an advisory opinion, just for obvious conflict of interest issues.
Sure.
I like working in media. I think it's a better fit for me. And really, if you're gambling, you can always do a little better gambling with some of this stuff, but it's best to be the house.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Yep. Do you think it's going to have an impact? I mean, we kind of watched how, you know, fantasy football in its own way kind of, you know, was a big part of the boom in the NFL over the past 25 years. And, you know, baseball, obviously fantasy baseball is, you know, maybe growing in popularity, but do you think that there's any kind of crossover there where the change to, you know, there being sports betting that's available to people is going to produce some kind of bloom and interest in baseball?
I think it'll help. I don't know if baseball is necessarily the most bet friendly sport there.
Yeah.
Because baseball isn't, I mean, you look at football and football isn't really a marathon in the way baseball is. It's huge events that happen one day a week, and the focus is on all of those events.
And you have plenty of time to think before the next one, yeah.
And so there's that kind of, you can have that kind of emotional rise and fall that you don't really get betting over the season. And baseball teams, I mean, everybody's kind of, you know, if you talk about, you know, true ability, that kind of nebulous abstract concept, every team's pretty much somewhere between like a 400 and a 600 team.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of randomness involving in baseball betting. And when you bet a lot, say on game lines, you have to bet a lot in baseball to have things kind of even out for you. Which is one thing I hate about it. I love prop bets. I do not love line bets.
The margin's just too small constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I'm not someone who is a compulsive gambler. I like to bet when I see opportunities.
Yeah.
Where I see, you know, expected value that I'm paid for my risk, essentially. And I do well with that at times. I had Max Scherzer winning the Cy Young that year, that first year that he was huge. I had the Braves winning the division last year, and it wasn't because I knew for some certainty that it was going to happen. I didn't really know Max Scherzer was really going to break out in 2013, but I was paid for, but I felt that the odds just, you know, paid off for that. It was a good value bet. I like value betting.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of bets I like better. And I don't know if that's exciting enough to really increase interest in the sport. But, you know, I've been wrong before. I'll be wrong again.
Yeah. Well, and then there's the question of betting on things that don't depend on the whim of various sports writers at the end of the year, because, you know, I don't bet much on sports. I'm in the stock market to some degree, and that's enough for me. But I did happen to put down a whole bunch of money on Justin Verlander to win the Cy Young in 2016, and I'm still mad about it, bro.
Well, I didn't.
I think I had 80 to 1 odds
on that one. I voted in the rookie of the year that year.
It's those guys in Tampa. They got
I voted for Corey Seager. If that's the year, was that 2015?
Yeah, 16? Yeah.
No, that was 2016. Okay. All the years are running together in my head over time. That's what happens when I get to middle age, I guess.
Yeah,
but no, I wasn't responsible for that in any way. It was kind of awkward because I did bet on Yelich coming into last season, so I actually would have had to turn down voting if I had been selected for the... Because they kind of just let you know, like, hey, you're voting in this year. Each Baseball Writers Association chapter head nominates who votes for what. So I would have to say, yeah, I can't actually vote for this because I kind of have a bet on it, which would really set off like the, even if nobody knew, it would certainly set off the ethical alarms in my head. But I vote for the rookie this year and I placed no bets on that. So I'm still 100%. I haven't gone full on.
You want to preview your voting
yet?
Yeah, you can't.
Oh, no, well, you actually promised not to, so I actually can't, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I have, because people ask me, like, to join in their Out of the Park Baseball League sometimes, like, their year to year. And I, like, tell them, you know, they use Zips for the last 3 or 4 years to start the season. So you would essentially be giving me the opportunity to project the quality of my team. I think Zip says that Billy Hamilton's going to hit 350 this year. Oh, he's on my roster. What are the odds of that?
Yes. Yeah, and then you stroke your tiny goatee evilly. Yes. So you'd be the house. Yeah, but you would be the house in that situation, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is I don't really have it in me to be corrupt in that way. I had this weird way of being obnoxiously honest about things. Like when I'm pulled over for speeding, I can never, even though you're supposed to say that you don't know why you're pulled over, I can't actually lie about it. If I know I have to say something, I can't it's kind of sad.
No, I'm kind of the same way. Like, if I'm directly confronted with the question, I have to answer it honestly. If I can kind of evade having to answer it, that's a different story. But...
Yeah, evading, yes. A lie of omission I do not see as a lie necessarily. But once you're asked a question, I cannot, because that's, I have this kind of thing that I have to be right. And that's one of my weaknesses, because I can't let arguments go.
Yeah.
But lying in a way means you're not actually right.
Yeah, and you're also kind of like corrupting the data in a certain way too, you know.
Yeah. So it's like, did you put your thumb on the scale with Billy Hamilton? If I lie and say no, I'm incorrect, and that just causes me pain. I think that's part of my upbringing, because I came from a very odd family of people who, it wasn't about, you know, being wealthy or successful or kind. It was about being correct. There are a lot of lawyers in my family, and the thing that would most like get you points in the family was being right and someone else was wrong.
Oh, Thanksgiving must be awesome.
Oh, I remember one Thanksgiving, my sister, I mean, she was way too old for this. She was like 20. I was like 25. I had said the word grandiose, and she was convinced the word was grandois, that it was spelled O-I-S-E. And she was too old to know that that wasn't the word. And she thought she was right. And so dinner had to stop while she went to find the dictionary, because this was like before internet was huge.
Yeah.
And she had to look it up and find out that the word was grandiose. And everybody knew that I had won and she had lost.
Oh, the shame. Yeah. She's never lived that down.
it kind of makes it sound like I come from a family of high functioning sociopaths, that it's possible. But I mean, spice of life.
Well, yeah, as long as you have like a, you know, a lighthearted attitude about it afterward, you know, there's nothing wrong with some healthy competition on that score. The whole country could do with a lot more of that in general. So, of the world.
Yeah, we once had, my sister and I once had a $50 bet about, did you ever read the encyclopedia? I don't know what your age is exactly, but did you ever read Encyclopedia Brown books as a kid?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm 44, Dan. Yep.
Oh, okay. So you're the same generation as me. Well, we had a bet, a $50 bet about the solution of an Encyclopedia Brown mystery from 30 years ago. It was the mystery. It was kind of not really a mystery, but it was Encyclopedia Brown was at a birthday party, and two twins were fighting over the last slice of cake, and they were trying to find a fair way to divide that cake. And Encyclopedia Brown decided the fairest way to divide that cake was one person cuts it and the other person chooses which one.
Oh, yeah.
And I told my sister that in the story, the one twin didn't do a good job cutting, and she gave her sister a bite of her cake at the end to kind of make it more even. And my sister insisted, no, she didn't. And so we had a fight over what at the time was a 30-year-old memory of an Encyclopedia Brown book. And of course, I remember I was right, she was wrong.
Yeah, that's the best part, is that you remember it pretty well. Yeah.
Like, don't you think you can remember Encyclopedia Brown mysteries more than me?
Oh, that's great.
Like, I know exactly what to do if you're in a bicycle race with an enemy school and the winner is who finishes last. You swap the bikes and go as fast as you can. See, I remember all that. And that's, I think there's probably information like birthdays and anniversaries, yeah, and I guess numbers to things like bank accounts that have probably been pushed out of my mind by all this foo-for-all.
Yeah, I've got a ton of useful or useless information. I'm definitely of the Jeopardy sort of persuasion on that front. Yeah, like, why do you know that? I don't even remember. I must have read it somewhere when I was 10. I have no idea, you know?
Which is why it's nice I turned out to be a baseball writer, because a lot of the really dumb information I have is baseball related.
Yeah, so it's all relevant in some way.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's say I'm an accountant for, I don't know, Citibank. In that case, the information about how Len Konecki of the Dodgers died when he was kicked off the team plane for being drunk, chartered a private plane, got in a fight with the pilot and tried to hijack the plane, and got beat to death with the fire extinguisher while they were trying to keep him from crashing the plane.
Oh, my God.
It's a great story if you write about baseball. If you don't, then... it's probably not, you probably want something more important to remember.
Yeah, it doesn't quite hold up against, you know, D.B. Cooper or something, you know. Yeah, so, all right. So then I'm really interested now because I want to know, like, there's a sense all around baseball that, you know, teams are getting smarter then, right? Teams are getting better at projecting their players. Obviously, there's the whole player development part of it. I read the MVP machine not too long ago. But in terms of, like, you know, figuring out, you know, where players really are right now and where they're going to be, do you really think that teams are much better at that? Or is a lot of this, you know, sort of, you know, just thin slicing certain stories that, you know, kind of paint it that way?
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
I think they're getting better. I don't think it's hugely so. I don't think it's a situation where they're just crushing in the projections compared to 30 years ago. Because even like from a projection standpoint, Bill James's Brock 5 did an okay job, as well as Marcel does. I think what teams excel at is they're much better at using the talent they have. Bill James used to have lists of what he called, for anyone who's not familiar, Ken Phelps All-Stars. Mm-hmm. And though that referred to minor league hitters that teams weren't giving chances to in the majors because of one thing or another, from he doesn't play good defense or things like that. You don't really see a lot of those guys now. Now, if you hit in the minors, you will eventually get a chance in the majors. I mean, Ken Phelps, in the early 80s, like you go into 82, he had like an 1100 OPS in AAA. And the Mariners just weren't super interested in him. They thought of him as a role player, maybe, if he made the majors. They called him up, sent him down, called him up, sent him down, used him only as a pinch hitter for years. And he wasn't even originally a Mariner. He was with, like, I believe, the Expos and the Royals, if I recall correctly. Teams use these guys more than they would 20 years ago. I think a good example is Nelson Cruz. He was kind of on that edge of a few more years and he might not have gotten a chance because he was someone who said, people said, oh, he won't hit in the majors. He didn't hit well his first time in the majors. He's a quadruple A hitter. 30 years ago, it would have been hard for him to get his first full season at age 28. Some could do that. I mean, Edgar Martinez eventually did, which was pretty good for the Mariners. But guys like that will eventually get chances these days, which is good.
Is that is that just the fact that scouting used to be kind of the end all be all, and now there's kind of other ways to look at it, where it's not just, you know, sort of the organizational attitude that fills up when the guy's in A ball and as he moves through the levels where you just don't expect anything and so you don't even pay attention? Is that kind of being over, you know, at least mitigated by the fact that they're, you know, they're breaking down all the data throughout the minor leagues? They've got the exit velocity, the whole panoply of bits of information to go through.
Having the data is, of course, huge. And it would be something that it wouldn't, if a scout didn't like a certain player, thought they were poor defensively, their minor league offense wouldn't counteract that. It wouldn't necessarily get them a chance. Now teams are happy to let players prove them wrong. I would say even a poorly run organization today, like the Royals or the Rockies, would probably be above average if you go back 30 years.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think a good example is Mike Yastrzemski of the Giants. The Giants aren't a traditional super stat organization, but they gave Yastrzemski a chance because they didn't have anything better to do with the at-bats, and it's worked out well for them. He looks like a legitimate major league player, not necessarily a star or anything. Obviously, he's helped by coming up in a season where his skill set has been exploded around baseball thanks to the baseball. weirdly, but I guess that's a that's an argument for another day.
But yeah, that is kind of a weird little fly in the ointment, though, because you just never know when it's going to go away either.
Yeah, that it is tricky. But the Giants gave Yastrzemski a chance to prove them wrong, and he did. Or to prove the Orioles wrong, I guess, since it's not like they had him for that long. But teams will give players chances this year, and there's very few players who will now go their entire career and not get a chance in their major league organization after playing well in AAA.
Yeah,
which is good.
Yeah, they're at least going to get a look at some point. Yeah, so you're not of the mindset that like Jeff Lunau, Andrew Friedman, these guys have just cracked the code and these teams are going to be just monsters for years to come. Or well, are some, you? Well, but some of that's some money. Yeah, yeah, the money.
I mean, some teams do it better than others. I think Jeff Lunau is very good at what he does.
Yeah,
but I mean, it's hard to stay ahead of the pack. It's just about being a little bit better, a little more creative, a little more taking a risk at the right time.
And then having an extra $80 million in payroll a year if you're the Dodgers or Yankees or someone, yeah.
But I talked about being opportunistic, and I talked about the Astros being opportunistic during their rebuild. But they've also been opportunistic while contending. And they saw a chance to get Verlander in a way that a lot of teams didn't think about. They had a creative way to make the money work, the players work for both sides, and to bring in Verlander. The same with Zach Greinke. You didn't see a lot of teams really going after Zach Greinke, but they saw a way to push and make it work. When the Astros won the World Series, they didn't just sit back and keep the core together. They went after Gerrit Cole very aggressively because that they have the idea is once you're a contending team, do everything you can to stay a contending team and to stay a top team. And they've done very well with that. And I think when the time comes that they aren't really top tier contenders anymore, I think that they will make trades. They will change direction before the team gets at just desperate straits. Because when the Orioles finally chose to rebuild, pretty much most players of value were gone. You can make the argument that the Tigers waited a year or two too long to fully jump into that.
Yeah, because they were trying so hard to win that one, whereas the Astros already have one. They might have another one by the time that point comes for them, which helps.
And of course, Mike Ilitch and his advanced age was a complicating factor. But I think just knowing the right making the decision at the proper time, it's just as good sometimes as making the proper decision in it to start with.
Yeah. Yep. Catching it when it's hot. Okay. So you obviously probably pay attention to all the hotness that's going on now with player development, that there's, they're getting better in theory at teaching players at identifying, small things that could be tweaked or adjusted to help hitters get better. I mean, is that something that you pay a whole lot of attention to?
I do. Of course, they don't share everything with me, but I glean a lot because, I'm in, being a writer also, I'm kind of inside baseball quite a bit. So you can glean some things. They're not always volunteering information. And I always thought that the Tigers should have been a little embarrassed when Verlander went to the Astros and started talking about all the data that they were showing him and how the Tigers weren't doing any of that, how the Astros seemed to know more about Verlander's slider than the Tigers did. The team should have been a little embarrassed by that, to have a guy who's been with you, for a decade.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing is he talked about how Brad Ausmus was the guy who actually got him to really start, looking at scouting reports and breaking down hitters. Like, he didn't even do that before. And it was Brad Ausmus who got him to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, which is a plus for Brad Ausmus. He's not a bottom tier, even if his relief usage is, headache.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think, to a lot of us, and when you're covering one team all the time, you see all their flaws, and it really does feel like the Tigers have been, like, woefully far behind. And I think, it's hard not to let that inform everything that you look at throughout the whole system. Like, when I look at, the Tigers don't seem to have got on to the fact that, you're going to need, guys who can show some plate discipline, at least at the A-ball levels, and have some power. Because if a guy can't lay off fastballs from 20-year-old guys who can't find the strike zone half the time, how are they ever going to improve from that? And it really feels on the hitter side like the Tigers have always been a little bit far behind on that. And you still hear, when Lloyd McClendon talks about hitting, he still talks a lot about wanting guys to spray line drives around the whole field, You know, the Tigers seem to obsess about the shift almost to an obscene degree. You know, the Tigers really want to hit for batting average. It feels like a lot of times when they discuss hitting, that's what they're talking about, is getting singles. And the game,
yeah, it's a very 1980 thing to talk about.
Yeah. And, you know, they're bringing in Kirk Gibson. You know, we've got Alan Trammell. I mean, obviously great players, Jack Morris, but a lot of these, you know, people from that era, and as well as Jim Leland, are still, you know, highly, you know, sought after advisors for this front office. And those are the things that really scare me when I look at the farm system and I don't see much in the way of hitters coming. I look at the fact that the Tigers haven't, you know, found, like, you know, you were talking about having the space to find a hitter. Maybe the Tigers haven't found a hitter, you know, in 4 years since Al Avila took over. They haven't had much success, you know, locating that one guy who no one else, you know, was on for whatever reason, getting a breakout.
They did get J.D. Martinez, and the Astros did it. So that is a victory there, at least.
Yep, that's true. But, well, that was quite a while ago. When was that? February 2014. Yeah.
It was a while, but I like to be scrupulously fair if I can.
Sure. Absolutely. I try as well. But, you know, sitting here watching the team be bad for 3 years, I'm sure at times I throw things and get more upset than I need.
Yeah, but again, remember, Orioles fan.
Yep, I hear you.
That team was bad. My entire young adulthood, they were a terrible team.
Yeah.
Like, I never had that experience of a good Orioles team as a young man. I mean, as a teenager, I did. Because, I mean, they had that back-to-back in 97 where they went from one wire to wire.
Yeah.
198 games. And that was the offseason that they at the sabermetric community called the Four Horsemen of the Ozpocalypse, because they brought in Doug Drabeck and Joe Carter and Norm Charlton and Ozzie Guillen and something in my throat. From 98 to 2013 or 2011, actually, I think they had a losing record every year.
Yeah. So, were you paying a lot of attention when you guys hit, you know, the Earl Weaver era, Eddie Murray, etc., the teams I remember from the mid-80s? Or is that a little bit too early for you?
Yeah, I was slightly too young to really appreciate it. I was a stat head very early. My grandfather bought me the Elias Baseball Analyst and the Bill James Baseball Abstract in 1985 when I was 7.
Oh, wow,
so
yeah.
I was reading this stuff fairly early. But I can't say I saw, like, a lot of their best early 80s years, because I was 5 in 1983. I didn't get to see that. I only really got to see the tail end of Earl Weaver's career,
yeah.
his second stint after Joe Altobelli, which did not go quite as well. That 86 was really disappointing when they kind of were, like, two games out in August and just collapsed down the stretch, and Earl Weaver retired.
Yeah. Now, that's interesting. I didn't, you know, I really missed out on all that. You know, I didn't know who Bill James was until probably like 2004 or 5 when I kind of came back to baseball after maybe 15 years away. So, yeah, I've been scrambling to catch up with all this.
Yeah, I got into the internet sabermetric community in the mid-90s when it was still kind of a new thing. And I guess that's kind of how I became employable, because I was with the right group of people at the time, where we talked data and made fun of web TV users and AOL users, because we were snarky, but it was a pretty invigorating environment, because you had people like Keith Law, Gary Huckabee, Clay Davenport, Christina Carl, Vorish McCracken, Sean Foreman. You can go on and on.
Wow, yeah.
That all these people, we were all like in the same place, the same little place on Usenet, arguing about baseball in the mid-90s, and somehow we all became employable, which is the weirdest thing I've ever.
That's a good group. Yeah, you guys were like the early adopters, you know. You were the Bill Gates, etc. of the sabermetric revolution.
Not quite as lucrative as Bill Gates.
Yeah, not quite.
I mean, we're all employable, but we don't have $50 billion even between us.
Yeah, that's the problem. The product was just information. There isn't a product to sell that easily. Yeah.
Yeah, it's useful, but you can't get a sabermetric. You can't get an on-base percentage, a slugging percentage stat into every home in America.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting that you mentioned, you know, the Verlander trade, because, I mean, the flip side to looking at what the Tigers got back for Justin Verlander, which doesn't look very good at this point, same with J.D. Martinez, is that other teams, you know, people forget about the flip side of it, which is that, you know, probably there's a pretty good chance the Yankees and Dodgers both cost themselves a World Series in 2017 just because they didn't want to give up whatever the Tigers wanted, you know, in terms of prospects. And, you know, maybe in a terms, you know, in terms of like pure value, that was the smart, you know, decision, even regardless if a World Series would have come their way. But it is easy to forget, you know, that that there's two sides to all this, and that, you know, yeah, the Tigers didn't get much for JD Martinez, but any team that wanted to come calling probably could have offered, you know, a 45 plus future value prospect and possibly walked away with that player.
Yeah, one of the things to remember is a lot of this also has is driven by the playoff format.
Yeah,
when you, the more playoff spots there are, even if they're wild cards, the more playoff spots you have, the more the proper strategy is to try to maximize how many times you make the playoffs, not how good you are in any one playoff season. And actually, I think having a second wild card actually helps a bit, simply because there's a much larger consequence for not winning the division than there was. I think that if the wild card didn't have to play a one game play-in, essentially, I know it still counts as the playoffs, but I still think of it as a play-in.
Yeah,
it's unavoidable. I think that it might be even worse, and you'd say teams be even more conservative at trade deadlines.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you'd know this, but like when the additional rounds of the postseason were being added, like when they, you know, they added the divisional series and all that, did strategy change then? I mean, is it like observable that more teams, you know, thought to themselves, I can get in, but also it's worthwhile just to try to get in and not necessarily go for, you know, the whole thing every time?
I think it was a slow shift from the strike years when they went to a wild card. As we kind of, it was part of the generalized shift between kind of an older school vibe around baseball to more of a modern analytics sense. And I think part of it is not going all in. And when you still see big trades, but they're usually for players now that are around for more than 1 year, because teams are going to look at it and say, you know, if we're going to be the team to give up these top prospects for a player, we want more than 2 months.
Yeah.
And I think some teams, I think that Tigers are one of them, have been slow to accept that, because the Diamondbacks got some really solid prospects for Zach Greinke.
Yeah.
But part of that is that the Astros get Zach Greinke for more than 2 months. They get him for, you know, the second half of 2019, and they still expect to be contenders in 2020 and 2021. So you can't just wait till a player has 5.5 years service time to trade them, if you do want to get value for that. So you largely see a lot of trades made for players that, when it's 1 year and change remaining, you think about Jeff Samardzija. No one would confuse, I mean, even good Jeff Samardzija as a serious Cy Young candidate most of the time. He did fetch, you know, Addison Russell to the Cubs from the A's.
Yeah.
And of course, he was a huge prospect at the time. I mean, Billy McKinney had value. They got good prospects. And part of it was because there was another year to go. And that's why, and Oakland had the opportunity to flip him again, which of course is exactly what they did. And they got back, you know, Fegley and Simeon, yeah, and other two names who I can't remember at this moment. And I'm going to be too slow to look up.
Well, but
I think I got that right.
No, yeah. But when and then when I compare that to, say, Matt Boyd, because I guess that, you know, Jeff Samardzija is an example I've used before where, you know, at that point back in 2012, I think, no, that was 2014 trade deadline, that back then you perhaps could get more for someone like Jeff Samardzija. Whereas, you know, the Tigers are trying to trade 3.5 years of Matt Boyd this summer. And it's really hard to say what the Tigers were asking, but yeah, it still feels like you might not even be able to get as much for, you know, as you could for Jeff Samardzija 5 years ago right now.
That's probably a fair point too.
Yeah. It's hard to say.
It's sometimes hard to remember what year everything happens now.
Yeah. Discover,
because when you're a kid, you have those grades that you're in to define,
yep,
everything that happened. When I was in third grade, my first year of high school, as an adult, you don't really have those same markers.
Yeah, it's just like a vague point in the semi-distant or far-distant past. Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the same job for 15 years, essentially, and I don't always remember what year things happen anymore. I just hope to hit them like, you know, 2 or 3 years within. That's my error range.
Yeah. I mean, if you know history and or pay attention to politics, like sometimes I can relate it to, you know, what I was thinking about in some other terms at the time. But yeah, it's not as easy as it used to be. That's for sure. Yeah. Okay. So, and then like to go back to Michael Fulmer, like thinking about trading Michael Fulmer after his rookie season, like, is there any way, let's say Michael Fulmer, you know, we just would have said, okay, this is a 3-4 war pitcher for the next, you know, 6 more years. Is there any way to get full value for someone like that at that point? Because I guess that's where I find it hard to really criticize the Tigers for not trading him, you know, back then, just because it just seems like it's really hard to get all those years of control in terms of value for yourself.
I think they would have gotten pretty good value.
You think so? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would have happened. To the right team that needed a pitcher like him, I think they get full value. The problem is, I think the Tigers thought that the full value was 5 years of a number one starter.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you what any of the offers were, because I don't know. You just hear rumors and never really find out what's accurate and what's not, because everybody in baseball is going to lie to you is one
sure
thing you need to understand as a writer.
Yeah.
But I think the Tigers felt differently, and teams would look at him as giving 5 years for a really good, you know, a number 2-3 guy. But that wouldn't have tempted the Tigers at that point, I don't believe.
Yeah. And if they were going to trade him at the end of 2016, that would have been the teardown, and they would have had to trade Verlander or, you know, JD Martinez, all those guys right then. And obviously they weren't willing to do that, having just committed some $140 million in free agent dollars the year before. So, well, no, it was way more than that. I forgot about Justin Upton.
And a late unrelated development while we're talking is Rick Okasek of the Cars has died.
Oh, no. Him and Eddie Money in the same week? For some reason, those two guys seem relatable to me.
I guess they go in threes, I hope. It feels like everyone who I remember as a kid is kind of dying or old. It's kind of sad.
It is at the point where that seems to happen, you know, almost weekly. And then I watch like younger people get all upset about them now, and I'm like, man, I'm over it already. It's happening like every day. Yet somehow Keith Richards and Mick Jagger just, you know, keep trucking along somehow. But yeah, for the rest of them.
Yeah, who would have thought they'd still be around in this old? It's always shocking when I'm like kennel surfing and I see Blue Bloods to see Tom Selleck that old.
Yeah.
And he's like the commissioner. It's like Magnum PI wouldn't be the commissioner.
You were the rebel.
Man. He's not the commissioner. He's not the straight-laced guy. And he's not like a rebel commissioner. He's a straight-laced guy. And I think, you know, I guess you could say that this is relevant because Tom Selleck is probably, I think, the most famous wearer of a Tigers cap.
Yes.
In pop culture.
Yep. That's accurate. Eminem never wore the Tigers cap enough to take over, I'm afraid. Sorry, Em.
Yeah, did Eddie Murphy wear one at any point during the Beverly Hills Cop movies? I'm trying to...
Well, he wore didn't he have the old English D on the jacket at some point? I don't know, there was definitely
He had a Lions jacket, I think.
Oh, the Lions jacket, that's right.
It had the big old helmet in it.
Yeah.
So I guess then Selleck is the most famous Tigers hat cap wearer.
Yeah, he's got to be. Other than Justin Verlander, I guess, you know, because now that he's married a supermodel, you know, he's living in a different sphere. I've actually been kind of wondering. Culture. Oh, for
you,
sure.
Yeah, you can't. He doesn't count. You can't count Verlander unless Verlander gets like a sitcom after the.
Don't count him out. It has been interesting following Justin Verlander since leaving, not just because of his performance, but just as a totally like frivolous tangent, in that it's got to be. Like, baseball players aren't that famous, like, you know, in terms of the larger popular culture sphere, obviously, compared to football players, basketball players, etc. But it's got to be interesting to be, like, the one or two baseball players who is now married to, like, a super famous woman who is tracked by paparazzi all the time. Like, Justin Verlander must exist at a whole different level. And I kept thinking about that when he got in the big kerfuffle for having the, you know, the Detroit Free Press writer banned from the clubhouse a couple weeks ago. All that kind of stuff. That he kind of exists in a different sphere where he has, like, his daughter who's probably being followed for pictures. You know, that whole thing. It's just a different ball of wax for guys like that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Mike Trout. If you put Mike Trout in a crowd and put, like, PewDiePie or Angry Video Game Nerd in a crowd, people would recognize the latter and more than Mike Trout easily.
Yeah, not even close. Oh, and that's sad news today. I mean, you know, the Angels aren't going anywhere, but kind of a bummer that Mike Trout will be lost to us the next 2 weeks, coming right on the heels of Christian Yelich, all these MVPs coming apart at the seams.
Yeah, we're going to see, now there's this worry that some dumbass writers are going to use as an excuse to not vote him MVP.
Oh, that can't happen. I
can predict that I will be very annoyed and complain loudly on Twitter.
Yeah, that can't happen, please. I mean, we already feel, you know, I mean, I had no problem with Miggy winning the MVP in 2012. I mean, obviously the Triple Crown, the whole thing, Mike Trout was brand new. You could argue the defense was a little bit, you know, overrated in terms of his war total that year, whatever. But I still feel bad about 2013 because, my God, Mike Trout, he's just unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's weird that he only has two MVPs.
It really is. It doesn't.
He should probably have about five. Even giving, you know, Mookie Betts the MVP last year, which was actually defensible, which is weird as it sounds, and even giving Miggy his Triple Crown one, he should still have like five MVP trophies.
Yeah,
it's absurd. It feels like time has passed that he's been around this long now.
It's kind of hard to believe he's 28 to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's. I mean, he came up in 2011 now.
Yeah. Oh, such a long time ago. Justin Verlander was really good back then. Yeah, still really good. I should probably save this question for Jay Jaffe, but how did you feel? Like, you know, you're someone who's, you know, intimately involved in determining player value. And what did you think of the Cy Young in the AL last year? Did you think that Blake Snell should have won based on kind of like an ERA type argument?
I think it was defensible. I don't think there was one clear-cut guy that you could say. See, I try now, because I'm mellower than I was 20 years ago, believe it or not. I try to save getting really, really angry for the things that deserve me being really, really angry.
Yeah.
I'm at the age I shouldn't get mad at everything, because all Hall of Fame voting every year has a tendency to make me mad. So I think, yeah, Blake Snell is a perfectly cromulent pick. you could pick Snell or Verlander or Kluber, Sale, or Bauer, or Cole. And I think they were all kind of in that same tier that you could make a legitimate case for all of them.
Yeah, no one blew anybody else away. Yeah.
It's not like when Dante Bichette was second in the NL MVP. I can't believe those idiots did that. Ugh.
Yep. Yeah. So you're not out there getting super upset over like tiny degrees of difference, like, oh, this guy's ERA plus versus this guy. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I try to get upset over stupid but large things.
Yep. Or world affecting things and not just baseball things, maybe. Although I still get upset about baseball things. It does happen.
Yeah.
All right, I got, let's see, I wanted to ask you about this too. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about, you know, the kind of the changes in player development, or at least the sense that teams are starting to figure out, you know, some new angles. Do you think that there's any chance, and I ask this because, you know, the Astros have kind of talked, they've cut scouting a little bit. There's been some talk about, you know, them not wanting necessarily their players to play minor league games as much as they might want them to actually try to train specific skills. And yet at the same time, we see that minor league baseball is increasing in attendance. Like, they had a huge jump this year. Prospects are the hotness. It's almost like, you know, the early 90s where like the hot prospects are like, you know, Nirvana breaking, or, you know, it's like, these are the hot bands in the baseball sense. And I just wonder what you kind of think about that, is whether or not, you know, we need the minor leagues as much as we've had them since the whole kind of system was put into place, or whether or not, you know, MLB might, you know, actually kind of lean in toward trying to monetize minor league ball more because of this. I don't know. How are you feeling about minor league baseball at this point?
I think it's hard to monetize it that much because it's still a minor league, and nobody's minor league really does that well attendance wise. I mean, you can say that for the NFL, that college football is the minor league, but that's a whole other thing because you have school spirit and people that go to these schools, and that's not really same as a minor league team. I think there's still a real use for the minors because you learn a lot from players just having them play games. The thing that teams worry about is they kind of want their staff to have as much of an impact on the players as every, you know, link in the chain going up. And they have a lot of control over it, but you have the most control when you're working with them every day, with your, you know, your major league staff and getting the best data possible and teams like that. But the minor leagues are still useful. I think the question is, do we need as many minor leagues as we do? And that I'm not so sure about. Every team has between 7 and 9 minor league teams, and I'm not quite sure we need that many. I don't know if, say, high A and mid A and short season A, I don't know if we really need to have 3 different kind of levels for that. And that is probably the question. I can see a situation long term where maybe, I don't quite know how it would work, but maybe teams will pool talent, open up that way, so you have fewer minor league teams. Of course, there's a lot of difficulties with that because you have to negotiate playing time because teams have different needs. But I think that would be a possibility if it could work out in the very long term. And I can see them trimming down the minors a bit.
Yeah. Is it possible that having all this data, I mean, it can't turn you into a juggernaut at the top and all these other teams are, you know, catching up to some degree, and eventually it just all becomes relative again, and, you know, it's just how you're doing compared to other teams and no one has a huge advantage. But maybe at the opposite end of it, it might get easier to tell which guys, like, no, this guy has no shot. Like, we can trim these 30 guys out of our system, eliminate a team, and it won't have any effect on our system.
It might, because if you trim down the minors, you're essentially going to have more of the cream of the talent play and fewer of the journeyman guys, fewer of the organizational players is what you call, because very few players in a system are real prospects.
Yeah.
You can take any like AAA league, and most, like, probably like 70% of the people in AAA right now will get at least an at bat or a appearance. And I can't know if I keep forgetting the word I'm going to use, and I keep going between an, but only a few of them are prospects. Like, you, like, if you look at Toledo, you see a lot of, you know, veterans, guys that were there on rehab, but you see players who are just essentially organizational talent. Like, I think, like, someone like Kyle Funkhauser, just to make a random name, I don't think anybody really thinks of him as a prospect at this point. Maybe I'm wrong and I'm just being mean, but I think he's more like an organizational player. And I think that when you turn on the minors, you might have fewer of those guys.
Yeah, yeah. Kyle Funkhauser specifically, I'd say, still has a chance to be a decent reliever, maybe even a solid reliever. But yeah, otherwise I would tend
they
to...
Haven't,
would tend
they to haven't be been using him as a reliever, though, yet, have they?
No, and that's something the Tigers have been a little slow to do. There's some pretty good arms who they're still using as starters, like Anthony Castro, Gregory Soto. I mean, these are guys who don't really have the command to go out there and give you 6 innings and not have an inning where they just blow up and throw the ball all over the place. But they haven't really kind of made that push. And when you were talking earlier about the Tigers maybe having a pretty good rotation, you know, within a year or 2-3 years, I think, you know, maybe the thing to look for all of Tiger fans is whether or not the Tigers start to try to work on a bullpen before then and be a little bit more creative maybe in their usage, which we've never have been. I mean, the Tigers more than anybody.
They were creative by getting Green back in the bullpen and not... Because I wasn't a fan of bringing in Green. I think that they pretty much overrated him based on his half a season with the Yankees.
Yeah, they faced him and got dominated by him. There's kind of a trend of the Tigers seeing a guy own their team and then going out and getting him.
Yeah. And I was pretty confused at the time because, I mean, he had a sub-4 ERA, if I'm recalling correctly, with the Yankees, but he also pitched worse in the minors. And I don't think anyone thinks that the majors are easier than AAA.
Yeah. And the FIP was still, you know, 440, something like that, you know, yeah.
But to their credit, they didn't force the issue too long. He got like one more year as a starter. Then they looked at him in the bullpen. And then when he could finally fetch something in return, and he did... If you had told me that Shane Green would fetch Joey Wentz plus a couple years ago, I would have been pretty surprised by that. So I think that actually did work out pretty well for them in the end.
Yeah, I like Joey Wentz. I'm actually kind of into it. And the Tigers have a couple of these like sort of high arm slot, you know, sort of invisible type guys going at this point. Tarek Skubal is kind of one of them. Franklin Perez was sort of another guy who's more fastball changeup than really breaking ball. Although he can't stay healthy. I don't know what's going on with him.
Although, speaking of Shane Green, it always struck me as kind of funny and sad that the Tigers lost you know, they essentially lost both sides of Robbie Ray trades.
yeah, they did. Well, and we gave away, you know, or we let Joaquin Benoit go and traded away Doug Fister, so also that we could get Joe Nathan. Like that was the end game of that one. Yeah.
I still hope that Benoit comes back. I don't think he's officially announced his retirement, because coming into 2019, he was one of three players left who were older than me. Benoit, Ichiro, and Fernando Rodney. Now we lost Ichiro. We might have lost Benoit because he hasn't pitched in the majors since 2017. So we might have lost him. And my last player who I need to stay around to keep someone older than me is now Fernando Rodney.
Yeah. Who's still throwing 96, 97, which is incredible.
And sometimes he even knows where it's going.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah. Yeah. Let's say, all right, one more little player development question. Because one thing I've noticed is that, you know, the Tigers were just finally kind of got on the ball this last offseason. And, you know, to whatever the value you can put it, if a team knows how to use all this technology or not, but they finally got all the Rapsodos and they got themselves some high-speed cameras and the force plates for hitters to balance on and see where their weight distribution is, all this kind of stuff. But I noticed that, you know, a lot of the agent camps, you know, and obviously with a lot of the MLB free agents kind of waiting the last 2 years and them setting up camps for them in the spring to practice, you know, independently. And then I hear Casey Mize last off season, you know, really worked on his own, like a new slider at his own agency's camp, you know, with all the technology and their own coaches. Is there anything that could ever happen there where agents actually kind of play and agencies start to play a role in player development that way, to where they might have their own camp, they might have their own sort of styles of teaching, all that sort of thing? Is that a potential thing ever?
I think it's possible. I think it might actually come from the other side. I could see an organization like Driveline Baseball. I could see them getting more involved in having an actual sports agency long term.
Trying to work on their own talent.
I don't have any specific information from Kyle Boddy about that. So don't take this as like some kind of rumor. But it wouldn't shock me if they became more active in that kind of thing. And I know that most of the agencies, they have, you know, analytics departments that do crunch numbers for players. I know because I've sold plenty of data to them. Even some of the smaller little agencies that do some of the, you know, the fringe guys who don't get big contracts. I think you could see that. I'm not sure how camps work because then you get friction with the team, but it is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just found it interesting. You know, that Casey Mize, you know, the Tigers spent their number one pick on him last year. You know, just didn't really pitch him much, you know, just gave him a couple innings and did some work with him at their Lakeland camp. And then to hear that in the offseason he was at his agent's, you know, camp and designed an entirely new pitch. And you just wonder, I don't really know how this goes with other teams, but it's always felt like the Tigers are really hands off in the offseason. Like there's not a whole lot of like, we want you to, you know, be on this, you know, this really strict diet and workout plan, and we don't want you to throw. It doesn't really feel like there's that much, you know, direction given. So I was kind of surprised that you know, he spent that much time working on something like that there. Obviously, you know, Matt Boyd and a host of other guys all go to Driveline in the offseason and kind of do their own thing. And yeah, I just wonder sometimes if teams, you know, have a say in that, or do they care that much, or, you know.
A lot of teams are involved, a lot of teams aren't. Are you familiar with what Adam Ottavino did?
Yeah, setting up a warehouse.
He set up a warehouse because he did things that the Rockies didn't think of.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's trying to make his own career. And I think teams like the Astros do take more of a hands-on approach with this kind of thing and look for these things. Because when players are fixing themselves and your major league staff isn't, then you have to be asking questions. It's like, this is one of those you had one job things.
Right.
Like, all you have to do is develop players. If players are developing themselves...
what do we need you for?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a question I ask, because I, you know, like some of these guys the Tigers have up, and I'm not any kind of an expert scout or anything, but, you know, I look at Dowell Lugo and, like, some of his actual swing issues and some of these other players, and I just wonder sometimes why teams don't talk to these guys when they're in the upper minors and just, you know, really hammer the point home to them, like, look, you know, everything has to change. Everything you're doing right now is never going to lead you, you know, to being a major league player unless you, you know, really try to experiment and try some new things. Maybe they do. Maybe they do talk to them, and players, you know, obviously have that inertia to where I've always done it this way. It's gotten me here. It's easy for me to sit here at my computer and say, hey, why don't you, trying to put the ball in the air more and keep your shoulder in and all this kind of stuff. But I don't know. It's just something I think about, because it does seem like an awful lot of guys, you know, it's sort of known when they're in the upper minors that their chances are very slim, and that, but often you don't see anything really radical, you know, happen with them or, you know, any attempt to really improve until, you know, they're in the major leagues getting their butt kicked. And by then, a lot of times it can be over. If you get called up to the major leagues and you play for a couple months and you're terrible and you get cut, you know, now you're not a prospect anymore. You know, now your career as an org guy who gets bounced around has begun. So,
yeah, I do think the Tigers could do more. When I talk about them, I don't think they're like at the bottom if I ranked all the front offices, but they don't strike me as very forward thinking or very just groundbreaking. You don't really see the Tigers as finding the next big thing over some other team. Like, if you asked like a group of serious baseball fans, what teams will find the next big thing? You get a lot of answers. People will say that it'll be like the Astros or the Dodgers or the Cubs or the Indians. Or
Segmedal comes to Baltimore and sorts you guys out.
I think for kind of a more conventional front office, the Tigers aren't bad. But I don't think that they're a great front office by any means.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in any kind of innovation, like sometimes it actually can pay to be the team that is like, you know, second in line, or, you know, a team that kind of lays back in the cut and, you know, lets other teams spend a lot of money trying to figure out like how much sleep, you know, each player should get and what they should eat and all these sorts of things. And then kind of like cherry pick the things that actually seem to have real effect, rather than necessarily being the team trying to push all that, because it's really hard. You can lead yourself all kinds, you know, down all kinds of rabbit holes. And anyone reading a lot of these articles, I'm sure a lot of the concepts or ideas that are being floated around as innovative right now will look like dead ends later. So, yeah, it's hard to know. It's hard to know. But do you think maybe we just make too much about that, though? Is that really just what it comes down to? Like, in the grand scheme of things, team building isn't necessarily, you know, impacted more than a percentage point or two by how innovative a player development system you have, that sort of thing?
I think it could be in a lot of cases more than a percentage or two. But yeah. I think that as time goes on, you'll generally see the difference in front offices kind of decrease. You'll always have teams that are rebuilding and teams that are contending. But it is harder to get an edge than it used to be. I mean, when during the Moneyball years, Oakland got an edge for just knowing what on-base percentage was.
Yeah.
It's nowhere near that easy now.
Nope. We're still waiting for the Tigers to really, really jump on the on-base percentage train, but we'll see. It's coming around, hopefully. All right, well, Dan, it's been great having you. I really appreciate you making time to do this. I've kind of been wanting to talk to you for a while, but I always figure you guys are super busy over there at Fangraphs. I don't want to just, like, you know, nag you guys for a little time for me. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me. It was fun. I believe I've done a podcast with you, but I mean, with Bless You Boys, but not you. I could be wrong. I've done a lot of podcasts and radio.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, anyway. I think it might have been. It was my predecessor, I believe. Yep.
Oh, who was that?
Hookslide or Al Beaton, one of the two. Might have been Al.
I don't think it was Al, but I guess that's not really a question for the podcast.
No, I guess not. It's a meta question about the podcast.
Yeah, that's a little meta, and we've already gone very long.
Yeah, we have. All right, well, I'll let you go. Thanks very much for being on, and we'll look forward to checking out everything you've got coming out at Fangraphs. Can you real quick just
The plug title part.
Well, just the especially that article, the Tigers season review article that you had recently, and anything else you've got coming up if you want.
I'm writing my next elegy for the season is the Seattle Mariners, so we can talk about Jerry DePoto and his 10 billion trades.
Yeah.
You can find me at Fangraphs. I'm senior writer for Fangraphs, contributor to ESPN.com, and you can find me at D Zimborski on Twitter. That's DESZYMBORSKI. If you don't know how to spell it, Google will fix it unless you're too far off.
Yep. Or just look up Zips projections or something and it'll all come up. All right. Thanks a lot for being with me, Dan. You have a good night. We'll talk to you later.
You do the same.
All right. Bye-bye.